A year ago today,
our work on this movement is now really just beginning.
Today, we'll talk about how the election of President Trump has affected our classrooms. Here's Naperville Central High School AP government teacher, Randy Smith.
I think trying to give students an opportunity to share their own particular views, but also to do that in a climate that is respectful and hopefully creating a climate that isn't attacking of someone's perspective.
Also, we find out more about the Rockford police officer, Jamie Cox, who was killed in the line of duty after a traffic stop early Sunday. And there's a shortage of educators who specialize in teaching low vision and blind students. In Illinois, there's only 200 or so teachers for the state's nearly 17,000 visually impaired students. The shortage is so severe, some advocates say we'll never catch up. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
It's my honor. It was an amazing evening. It's been an amazing two-year period. And I love this country. Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you remember that was 1 year ago today. And in the past 12 months, the political climate after the election of President Trump hasn't gotten much more civil. If we talk about our civic climate, not just across the country, also in our classrooms. Researchers at UCLA recently surveyed more than 1,500 teachers across the country. And most of those teachers said they've heard concerns from students about safety because of what they're reading in the news. Half said students are experiencing, quote, high levels of stress and anxiety. Today, we wanted to check in with some Illinois public school teachers and learn how they're navigating our tense political climate in their classrooms. I'm joined now by Randy Smith. He's a social studies teacher at Naperville Central High School, where he teaches AP government and politics. Also on the line from Evanston is Bill Farmer. He's a science teacher and instructional coach at Evanston Township High School. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Randy, let's start with you. You teach AP government. So I imagine, actually, I've thought about this a lot in the past year, especially with the travel ban and looking at how courts responded. It's actually a really interesting way to see our system of checks and balances and the three branches of government working together. Do you feel like in some ways students have an opportunity this year to see how our branches of government interact with each other in real time, and it's been a learning opportunity?
Well, most definitely. And that's one of the exciting things about teaching government and giving kids opportunity for civic engagement is there's always something happening. And this year, most definitely, where students are, you know, seeing, you get to see the checks and balances potentially lived out. Hey, an executive order of a travel ban, a court says check. And so that's been a neat opportunity, I think, for us to follow along, to analyze and critique as we go, but then also to see how government really wrestles within itself, right? And honestly, to see some of the things the founders thought about being played out is exciting.
That said, is it also harder? Do you think within the classroom environment, would you say that things have become more heated over the past year among your students?
I have not necessarily seen the heatedness, and I think maybe part of that is hopefully we can foster an environment of open discussion, but also not make it personal, and as well trying to find that happy balance of, you know, big in Illinois this year is the social-emotional learning, and so how do we work on social-emotional learning skills like being an active listener, and maybe listening first before opening the mouth, not trying to win arguments, but trying to have discussions. And so those have been, I think, the unique opportunities, perhaps more, even more facilitated in light of some of the political climate.
Right. I want to get back to that in a second. But, Bill, can I ask you, do politics come up in science classes?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that has been challenging sometimes is when you're talking about global climate change and then you see comments on the news and students come in, sometimes it's become difficult to navigate what is actual evidence. And so skepticism is kind of a healthy thing in science, but we kind of have to foster an environment where students are actually looking at data and analyzing data and not just being a skeptic for the sake of being a skeptic, but trying to kind of embrace conversations around some real issues in terms of how politics and science overlap.
Yeah, for both of you, Bill, let's start with you. Do you feel like this year, and Bill, I think especially if you're thinking about climate change and the conversation around climate change for people who do not believe that it happens, do you feel like that puts more pressure on you as a teacher to create a respectful and engaging environment for your students, Bill?
Yeah, I definitely think it's key to establish norms within the classroom in terms of how we're going to approach science and how we're going to be able to listen to different perspectives but present our information in respectful ways. And then always kind of circling back to, you know, that's an interesting perspective. Can you find the data or the evidence that supports the claim that you're making? And so I think, you know, sometimes there's frustration, too, because as we're talking about something and students are seeing, like, wow, this is really an issue, and then they see, like, why are we the only country not engaging in the Paris Climate Agreement? That creates some opportunities to have some maybe non-science discussions, but it's really my role to facilitate those discussions in a safe way so that students can kind of get their viewpoints out there.
We're talking about politics in the classroom, how teachers have been navigating this across Illinois high schools this year. My guests are Bill Farmer. He teaches at Evanston Township High School. Randy Smith is also on the line. He teaches AP Government and Politics. He's a social studies teacher at Naperville Central High School. Randy, do you feel like there's more pressure, as Bill was talking about? I wonder if this is something you talk about with your colleagues about creating an environment where you can have respectful but intellectually engaged with your students?
Yeah, I mean, it's perhaps a daily challenge, right? We want to have lessons and activities and discussions that have positive educational outcomes, right? That allow us, I mean, if we're trying to develop quality citizens, better humans, you know, we need to work through difference, work through challenge. And so part of it is, you know, working with colleagues in lesson design. You know, we're in a model of professional learning communities. So in our teams processing, hey, what worked well for you and what didn't work well? What were some of the, you know, just being vulnerable with each other and saying what were some of the things that flopped and how we could do better? I mean, bottom line, all those things are our attempts to try to provide a viable incredible and quality education for our kids.
I mentioned that UCLA study. It was called Teaching and Learning in the Age of Trump. And one teacher said in that study, quote, I'd been trained to bring all different student perspectives into the discussion, but I don't know what to do, quite know what to do when it creates a threat for other students or undermines a sense of community in my classroom. And I'm thinking this probably, I'm thinking about some middle school teachers I talked to before and right after the election, who were very worried about children saying to other children, like, oh, your family's going to be deported. And I don't know if that happens more with younger children or with older children or with high school students. Randy, I wonder how, if that resonates with you, if you worry about that with students.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, one of the things I think back a year ago, right, and on that Wednesday, so if we go back actually a year in terms of the day of the week, it was a Wednesday that the election on Tuesday, it's my Super Bowl, so I'm up late, I'm exhausted, surprised by what we saw as the outcome, but knowing that I'm going to have a group of students who we've looked at a lot of different elections in the nation, we've made predicting results, now we're going to process. And I know that day and the days thereafter, there were definitely students who were really scared and concerned, maybe because they were Muslim, for instance. And we definitely have a significant Muslim population here. And so one of the things that I tried to do was, all right, what are some of our concerns? What are some of your fears? To share those openly, and then to kind of walk down one of those roads. Like, what is a worst-case scenario? But then to say, what, and this is great connection for our students, but what are the checks in that process that other parts of government or that people might play? And so I hope it was a bit of instilling of hope, but also it was a way for them to process and a way for them to process in the context of our political system. And so to see that, hey, a travel ban, Muslim travel ban, I don't know, but a travel ban, and then to see, well, what checks could happen, and then also this semester to obviously see those things happen, right? And so to me, that there's lots of teachable moments. I think that that's hopefully us trying to handle students with care and concern.
Bill, do you have that also? I wonder, do you feel like, I don't know if you've had situations where students have said things that you feel are inappropriate or how you try to kind of create an environment that Randy's talking about?
Yeah, personally I haven't, but I do know, like, I've had colleagues or friends of mine who teach in other districts that have had situations where students have kind of made what would be a pretty offensive comment in the midst of a classroom discussion. That would put some students in a space of discomfort. And I think sometimes it's hard for teachers to know exactly how to respond in that moment. And it's through kind of practice establishing these guidelines for respectful dialogue and then creating space for students to get their reactions out there. And sometimes that can be facilitated in a discussion, potentially with older students in a high school level. At other grade levels, you may have to find other outlets for students maybe to write about how they feel about how something was said and then kind of facilitate a conversation to get students to really think about the perspectives that they're sharing and how those perspectives may impact the people in their learning community.
Randy, what would you do? I mean, I think that's really hard. And I actually think as you all are talking, I'm thinking probably adults could learn a lot from what you all are doing in your classroom about creating respectful dialogue. Randy, what's your, I don't know, as Bill said, you know, he's seen this happen with colleagues and they've had discussions. What is sort of the procedure if someone says something inappropriate or offensive to another student in your classroom, Randy?
Yeah, I mean, I love, first of all, what Bill outlined is having kind of classroom norms and also giving them some space. I think that's spot on and just a great approach, irrespective of the discipline, right? I don't know if there's one answer. I mean, honestly, it's a personal decision based on who I am and one that tries to reflect, hopefully, consistency in values and treat people with dignity and respect. So sometimes it might be something that we just move on from, and I address with a student one-on-one later. It might be when somebody brings something to my attention of how they were offended, that then maybe we need to have a conversation, or myself, that offended student, and maybe the offender need to have a conversation. And sometimes it's appropriate, I think, to address it in front of our, you know, with one another in a whole class setting. So I don't know if I would say I have one immediate, this is the only way to handle it. But I think we're trying to be human with one another, and we're looking for ways to, again, you know, develop social-emotional learning. And so possibly you turn the question back to the student. You know,
what does that mean, social-emotional learning?
Yeah, it's, I mean, one, we can say, hey, there's academics, right? There's specific things that we're tested on, but really as a state, we have worked towards realizing that we're trying to educate a whole person. And a lot of times we can have academic richness and maybe social, you know, weakness or incompetency or just struggle in certain areas. So someone who might know an answer and have an opinion to just blurt that out, well, maybe we need to learn what's an appropriate time and what's an appropriate context for a particular thing to be said, right? Or how do we treat each other? You know, we encourage students in our district to be the three. In other words, if there's a conversation of two people, and one is maybe saying something aggressive or bullying, let's say another, be that third person who steps in or distracts and in some senses maybe runs to the defense of the one that may be being attacked. So trying to equip students with skills to be equipped to learn, but also skills that in one sense, or maybe those soft skills that we all need in our careers and our professions.
My last question to both of you, I wonder what you feel like your role is in affecting civic and political life and if how that's changed in the past year. Bill, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you talked about, like we really are trying to model for students how to engage in conversations and recognize that we're not always going to agree on things, but we need to be able to listen to different perspectives and thoughtfully respond to each other. And I think that in this kind of heightened political environment, you know, it's pretty noticeable as somebody who's been teaching for 15 years that the climate in the classroom sometimes is a little bit more tense, and students, especially right after the election, but then as we process certain things throughout the year, you know, there's different conversations that are happening, and they're watching how adults are conducting themselves in the real world. And I feel a sense of responsibility to impart on them ways that we can be better about engaging with each other and moving forward and making decisions and having discussions in ways that, you know, we can express our viewpoints, but we can do so in ways that are constructive.
Randy, we just have about a minute.
Yeah, and, you know, for how do we help students maybe manage the emotions that come with a political view, right? And to then, as ones that we want to have them in, you know, grow in their engagement in terms of you know, civic engagement, how do we help them create goals and move towards those goals with respect for one another, with maybe more responsible actions? And that's a challenge, but it's a fun challenge that we really try to give them opportunities for that engagement, but also give them, you know, the skills to move through that with some tact, right?
Yeah. So, well, something I think we could all learn from, right? I think a lot of adults in this country could benefit from being in both of your classrooms. So I want to thank Randy Smith, who teaches social studies at Naperville Central High School, and Bill Farmer, science teacher and instructional coach at Evanston Township High School. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you, Nyla.
Listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This weekend in Rockford, a police officer, Jamie Cox, and a 49-year-old man, Eddie Patterson Jr., died early Sunday after what authorities said began as a traffic stop. Now an autopsy report is concluding that the officer's death was murder. Nearly 100 people gathered on Monday night at the place where Cox lost his life about what happened to cause the loss of both lives. WNIJ's managing editor, Victor Yaling, was in Rockford on Monday night. He's been covering the story, and he joins us from there. Victor, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Nyla. Thank you.
Before we get to your impressions of the vigil, Victor, what can you tell us about what authorities understand to have happened on Sunday morning?
Basically, what happened is Officer Cox stopped a white pickup truck with improper license plates on a side street just west of Rockford University on Rockford's east side. Somehow he became entangled with the vehicle, which drove away from the traffic stop and ended up crashing into a tree on the property of the Unitarian Universalist Church about two blocks north. Somewhere in there, Officer Cox managed to fire his weapon, and he struck and killed the driver, but the impact of the crash caused massive injuries to Officer Cox, and he died from those injuries.
Oh, dear. And I imagine now we're learning a little bit more about Officer Cox. What do we know about him?
Well, he was 30 years old. He had been on the department less than a year. He joined it in December of 2016. He's a graduate of Honeniga High School in Rockton, which is just a little ways north of Rockford, and he previously had worked for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Law Enforcement Division, and he also served in the National Guard. He was eager to be a police officer and transferred from the Law Enforcement Division at DNR into the Rockford Police Department last December. So he hadn't been on the street a long time. He was traveling on his own. His car didn't have a video camera in it, so we don't know exactly what happened. It's all speculation. There was one witness who said he saw the truck going by at a very high speed, but couldn't really offer a lot of other help in terms of specific details about Officer Cox's death.
And do we have any details from the autopsy? And I understand there's also a task force from the county that's investigating the use of force in this incident?
Well, the autopsy of Officer Cox said that he died from massive trauma. Basically, when the vehicle slammed into the tree, Officer Cox was injured by the impact, and those injuries are what caused his death. The driver, Eddie Patterson, died from gunshot wounds, apparently from two wounds, but his body was also injured from the crash. And that's what they're working on. The task force is actually doing a follow-up investigation, the same kind of investigation they would do in any incident where a police officer in the Winnebago Boone County area used force in an incident. They are examining Officer Cox's use of force, firing his weapon in this particular instance.
Victor, what do we know about the truck driver? What do we know about Eddie Patterson Jr.?
Well, the background we have on him is somewhat sketchy. It's provided by his family. He's had some difficulties in the past. Apparently, he has had driving citations, driving without a license or after revocation. And that may be the reason that his vehicle did not have proper license plates on it. According to his family, he bought the truck off of Backpage or Craigslist or one of those sites on the internet and obtained license plates somewhere so that he could drive around the city. And he was out driving at the time that he was pulled over by Officer Cox.
Victor, you mentioned that this all happened on the grounds of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Rockford. There was a vigil on Monday night that was honoring Officer Cox, and it was hosted by the minister of that church, Reverend Matthew Johnson. You were there. Let's hear a little bit of what you were recording.
I hope that tonight's prayers will allow us all to grieve and express our care and sympathy and recommit us to this work of building this world. In the memory of Officer Cox and all those who give their time and their energy, and sometimes tragically but heroically their lives.
That's the Reverend Dr. Matthew Johnson, Senior Minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Rockford, who hosted that Monday night vigil. Victor, what was it like? I imagine a solemn vigil. What were folks in the crowd talking about and feeling?
They were feeling, obviously, sadness, grief for the officer and for his widow, but there was also expression of sorrow for the death of Eddie Patterson. Both Dr. Johnson and some of the other clergy people who spoke mentioned that it wasn't just one person who died in that incident, that we need to remember that there are more lives touched than just police and individuals in the community, that there are victims of all sorts who need to be considered, and to pray for relief from the violence that plagues our country, our community, our world, so that we can have a peaceable world.
And the funeral's this weekend?
Yes, the funeral is on Saturday. There's a six-hour visitation beginning at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. It'll run until 9 p.m. They have a special law enforcement walkthrough at 6 p.m. where officers who are coming to pay tribute will come in together and pass by Officer Cox. And there also will be a police funeral Saturday morning. This all takes place at the First Free Evangelical Church on Rockford's east side. Possibly one of the most moving tributes will be the procession which will follow the funeral. After the funeral, the hearse with Officer Cox's body and a procession of law enforcement vehicles will travel from east to west along State Street, the main east-west artery in Rockford, to the far west side and turn south and come back to Broadway, which is another east-west artery, and travel back to the East Side Cemetery where Officer Cox will be buried.
So it sounds like a long day of mornings for Officer Cox. I want to thank Victor Yaling, who's the managing editor of WNIJ, one of our partner stations in Rockford, for updating us on this tragic story. Victor, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla. My pleasure.
We've all heard about the big teacher shortage that has long plagued Illinois education. Unfortunately, the situation only gets worse when we're talking about teachers who specialize in educating low vision and blind students. There are about 2.4 million students in Illinois overall when we think about grades kindergarten through 12th grade. And of those, nearly 17,000 students have low vision or blindness. I want everybody to think back about how hard it was for you to grasp some of the abstract aspects of math and science when we were that age. And then imagine how difficult it would be if you couldn't even see the whiteboard or textbook. And here's how bad that teacher shortage in Illinois is. There's actually only one teacher for every 79 visually impaired students. Unfortunately, similar statistics can be found across the U.S. And there aren't very many programs dedicated to training individuals who want to teach blind students. In fact, only two of all of our colleges in Illinois offer degrees with that specialization: Northern Illinois University in DeKalb and Illinois State University in Normal. Joining me now are educators from both of those places. Olaya Landa-Villard is on the line with us from ISU. Olaya, she's an assistant professor of low vision and blindness. Also on the line with us from NIU are Associate Professor Stacy Kelly and Professor Emeritus Galen Kapperman. In addition to being an educational expert, Galen is himself blind after being born with Stargardt's disease, the most common form of inherited juvenile macular degeneration. Olaya, Stacy, Galen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
Good morning.
Yes, nice to be here.
Good morning. Stacy, when we think about this, there's just over 200 teachers in Illinois who are specially trained to help these students. Can you help us understand how big of a crisis this is?
Oh, sure. Yes, this is a crisis that has existed for more than a half century. So this does not only span the current times we're in, but it is a long-standing crisis as well in terms of the duration of the crisis. It's nothing new. The research shows also that this crisis will continue to exist and that we will never catch up to the desperate shortage for teachers of children who are blind. This is a situation also that is not isolated just to Illinois. It's nationwide.
And when we talk about Illinois, is this concentrated in certain areas or is it more widespread?
We hear from people all over the state of Illinois anxious to recruit the graduates of our program before they even start our program. And so the people who are contacting us from school districts and agencies are located throughout the state of Illinois.
Galen, you began working at NIU in 1974. I wonder, as you listen to Stacy talk about how long this crisis has been going on, is this something that, is this a similar conversation that you were actually having in 1974 to the one we're having today?
Absolutely. The situation is really desperate because there are kids who just either don't have teachers, or the services for the kids have been cut back to the point where I don't want to say that they're meaningless, but they're not being served at the point, at the level at which they deserve and should be served. That is how some administrators cope with this this problem. And it's against the law, federal law, to have blind children in the schools without a certified teacher. And so it's a problem. There's no question about that. And we advertise widely. We try very hard to get as many people as we can interested in becoming a teacher of blind and visually impaired kids.
Mm-hmm. Elia, there's thousands of colleges and universities in the U.S., and there's only a few dozen that offer degrees that specialize in teaching low vision and blind students, ISU and NIU being here. Why do you think that is?
Well, there used to be more, but as far as training programs, the issue has become not only do we have the shortage of teachers to go out and serve students who are blind or visually impaired or deafblind, but because we also have a shortage of personnel preparation people, shortage of professors who specialize in training teachers to become teachers of the visually impaired, because we have a very a lot of our field, I should say, is getting ready to retire, and they have been retiring, and there's nobody to take their place. So when you have nobody to take their place in these programs, programs close. They have to have professors to run the programs, the personal prep programs. So that's part of the big problem that's been happening across the country. And there is a program that is working to help fill that gap. It's called the National Leadership Consortium in Sensory Disability. And its first iteration was called the National Leadership Consortium in Visual Impairment. And basically, it's a program that pays for people to get their doctorates in these specialized areas of visual impairment, deaf, hard of hearing, or deaf blindness. And Stacey Kelly and I are actually products of that fellowship program. So we were able to get jobs in higher education to keep our programs open.
And Olaya, when you think about that, as you're thinking about the fact that there's paid programs, it sounds like there's a lot of incentive out there for teachers to go into this. Mm-hmm. Do you think part of the problem is just that people don't know that this is a field that they could specialize in?
Yeah, I think it is a big part of the problem. I know just from my own personal experience, I've always wanted to be in this field. But when I graduated from high school, it was kind of like I was, told, oh, well, go into education and you'll be able to teach these students, because even our guidance counselors didn't know that this was an actual field because we're so low incidence. Most people go through their entire teaching careers and never have a student with a visual impairment in their classroom. So how would you know that there's an actual teacher of the visually impaired who would come in and collaborate and work with the teacher in the inclusionary general education setting? And so that's, I think, a big part of it. People come back to get their teacher certification in visual impairments once they've been out in the classrooms, and they get a student in their classroom who is blind or visually impaired or deafblind, and then they start realizing, wow, how can I best serve this student? And then they start researching for programs to train them to become either a teacher of the visually impaired or figure out how work with the teacher of the visually impaired who is assigned to that particular student who they have. And so that's kind of how they find out about it. They find out kind of later versus right when they graduate from high school going into a university program. And so it's that lack of visibility, I think, for our profession that I think is contributing to this crisis that we have.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. That's Ola Landa Vallard from Illinois State University. Stacey Kelly and Galen Kapperman are on the line with us as well from NIU and DeKalb. Stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about, I'm curious how you all got into this field, and also hear a little bit more of your story, Galen. Stay tuned to the 21st. We're going to pick up this conversation just after this short break.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the teacher shortage in Illinois as it specifically relates to low vision in blind students. Required by federal law, as one of our guests were pointing out, Galen Kapperman's with me from NIU, along with his colleague Stacy Kelly. Olaya Landa Villard is also with us from Illinois State University. All three of these folks have been working in this field for quite some time. And I just wanted to go back to just sort of the whole notion of how we learn today, Stacy, and just ask you about how much more, I'm thinking of how much more of our education is visual, especially as we're asking students to learn on tablets or laptops in the classroom. Of course, we've got whiteboards and textbooks and videos. Stacy, do you think that the technology makes this a little bit easier, or is it harder when we're thinking about low vision or blind students and resources in the classroom?
Nyla, you bring up a really good question, and people who are blind or visually impaired cannot see the information displayed on a computer screen. Instead, they have to be trained to use specialized assistive technology that enables computers to talk, for example, or speak what's on the screen. And there is a wide range of assistive technology available today that does make it very possible for people who are blind or severely visually impaired to use the same computers and devices that sighted people use. And so it is very possible to be on a level playing field. The thing that makes all the difference in that, though, is having the knowledge and skills to do so. The research actually shows that the vast majority of people who are blind are not receiving the training that they need with assistive technology, that children in the schools do need more instruction with that, and that would come as no surprise given the severe teacher shortage. And so actually the field of visual impairment recognizes this, and most recently the field has created a new credential to address this additional crisis that children who are blind do have to be able to launch a Google search, do word processing, send an email, those sorts of things. So we have a brand new credential in the field of blindness and visual impairments that our teachers also receive here at Northern Illinois University. It's the first program anywhere in the world where individuals can become trained in using the technology to enable children who are blind to do the same skills on computers and other sophisticated technology devices as their sighted peers. We're very excited about it, and it is a very promising thing for our field. Again, we are actively recruiting for that program. The graduates of the program receive 3 to 4 job offers upon completion of the program, so we say 300 to 400% job employment rate for our graduates, because the need for this knowledge is so important at this time.
Galen, I imagine things have changed quite a bit from when you were in school in terms of technology, the tools that are available now, as opposed to when you were growing up as a child in school being blind.
They certainly have. I can't even describe how different it is now. When I was in elementary ed and high school youngster, I did not have any special teachers, special ed teachers. I was low vision. The Stargardt's is a disease in which it's a genetically caused disease in which your retina deteriorates over time.
So it's degenerative.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is degenerative. That's exactly right. And I started out life as a low vision youngster, and over the years, my eyesight diminished, got worse and worse and worse, until currently I am totally blind. And I use all of the technology, or much of the technology that Stacy was just talking about, and I have no idea how I would do my job as a professor if I didn't have access to the equipment that we have now. I wanted to just support Olaya's assertion that it's difficult to find professors in the area of blindness and visual impairment. When I graduated many, many moons ago, I was the only candidate available for a job at a university training teachers of blind children. There were 2 jobs available, one at Ohio State, one at Northern Illinois University, and the professor here recruited me. I came out to interview, was offered the job immediately. That's how things changed. And I I did not get a call back from Ohio State University because the long story quickly, one of my recommenders had his secretary had sent both letters of recommendation to the guy here at NIU. He forwarded the recommendation that was supposed to go to Ohio State and said, better luck next time, Dick. He knew him. We've got him. That was without my interviewing. And of course, Dick at Ohio State, why should he respond? when it looked like I had already taken the job, I went back to Colorado. I graduated from the University of Colorado, and I went back to Colorado, waited for indication from Ohio State, didn't get anything, decided, okay, well, I'm just not good enough for Ohio State. I'll take the job at Northern. And I did, and I have never regretted that. That was one of the best tricks that was ever played on me. I love teaching at Northern. Northern is an outstanding university, and I am so happy that I am in the Chicago area rather than in Nowheresville, Ohio.
Galen, can I ask, as you were touting the program and as we're thinking about this whole issue of just recruiting teachers, I want to go back to what you said about the fact that it's actually the law. It's legally required by federal law. It's for these young people to have educators there to help them. As someone who knows how difficult it can be to go through school, as you said, things were so different when you were going through school, I wonder if you can just answer for me how much of a difference you think a specially trained educator can make in a child's education.
I have an excellent example of that. I have two sisters who have the same disease I have. Now, I learned Braille as a 16-year-old, because the people who were the Commission for the Blind sent an instructor once a month on a weekend to teach me Braille. My sisters did not have that service available to them. I don't know why. We all were low vision at the time. They are now totally blind like I am. Neither one reads Braille. They are much more dependent upon others to help them because they can't read Braille. They're, for all intents and purposes, illiterate. And Braille has just an enormous benefit to a blind person. Let me just give you one example. In my home, I have a gymnasium that's reasonably well equipped. And it has, and the treadmill and all of the other equipment have touch screens on them. And I have Braille on those touch screens. If I did not have the ability to read Braille, I wouldn't even be able to use a microwave or any kind of device. That's just a very simple example of how important it is. And when the kids don't have a certified, well-trained teacher to provide the services, the special instruction that they need, they will suffer from the lack of that instruction for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, Stacey,
it's a tragic situation. It really
is. I mean, yeah, Stacey, as Galen's talking about this, so is Braille then taught, so is this part of your program that teachers learn Braille, Stacey, at NIU?
Absolutely. Every single teacher candidate that will work with children who are blind in our program must be proficient. And actually, it's so important. It's the first skill they're required to master upon entry to our program.
Well, I imagine the same thing for ISU?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Everybody has to have master Braille. And then they also have to master NEMETH, which is the math code, as well. And, you know, when Stacey was talking about assistive technology, you know, we know that that's not really a cheap. Assistive technology devices are not extremely affordable for many people, especially those devices that are specially designed or have special software for students who are blind or visually impaired. And a lot of that equipment comes from the American Printing House for the Blind. And the quota funds that were allocated by the federal government back in 1879, those quota funds are managed by trustees in each state. And right now, the quota funds for students is at about $269 per student, which that's barely going to buy Braille paper for for our students. And right now, American Printing House for the Blind has a campaign called Keep the Promise campaign to help raise those quota funds from $269 per student to $1,000 per student. I mean, the average cost to educate a student in the 10th grade physics class is about $1,500. That same cost or that same class will cost $36,000 to educate a student with blindness or visual impairment with the material, the specialized assistive technology and materials they need.
So Aliyah, I'm sorry, can I ask you, when did you say those standards were set? At what year?
In 1879.
So you did say 1879, and when has it changed?
Well, it wasn't a standard. It's the quota funds that the federal government mandated that each state receive quota funds for each registered student for their state. And so then for every state, each student who is registered through the American Printing House for the Blind with their quota system, each student is assigned $269 for specialized materials. However, that amount of money hasn't changed
right.
in many decades.
Oh, and yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like that's certainly not enough. Can I ask you, Aliyah, there's something you're also working on, advocating for some federal legislation that would help address knowing exactly how many visually impaired students
yes.
are in a school, because that's
yes.
another problem?
Yes. Actually, it's the piece of legislation is called the Cogswell-Macy Act. And just yesterday, Senator Edward J. Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Senator Shelley Moore Capito, from Republican West Virginia, introduced this bipartisan legislation that will help strengthen the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act for kids who are visually impaired, blind, hearing impaired, or deafblind. And so part of that Act, now that it's been introduced in the Senate, we really need to get, people need to call their senators and representatives to tell them that they support this bill. It basically requires states to identify and evaluate children who are visually impaired, hearing impaired, deafblind, or low vision so that we can get a more accurate number of how many children we really have in each state to justify why we need to be training more teachers to go out and serve students. And so because right now the kids are counted differently in each state, and I know that sounds weird, but a lot of our kids, if they have, let's say, a visual impairment and a speech impairment and maybe another impairment, they're lumped under a multiple disabilities category, which really doesn't specify what disabilities are in that multiple disabilities category for them. And so it looks like we don't have as many kids as we really do have. And so trying to make sure we get a more accurate number, we can then approach like our state.
Right. It's a way for you to sort of resolve the problem
to see if we can get
and
funding.
Decide them.
Right.
We just,
funding for our states to train more people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We just have about a minute left.
Okay.
Galen, I just wanted to ask you just a final thought as we've talked about this problem. It sounds like there's so many different aspects of it. I just wonder if there's any final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with. Galen?
Well, I would say that teaching blind kids is an extraordinarily rewarding career. And I have on the Internet, I have a video that I ended with saying, if you want to do something to make the world better than what you found it, teaching blind kids is a career for you.
Absolutely.
And,
I agree.
And it's extraordinarily rewarding. And ISU and NIU, we're here for you. Just come and talk to us. And you can become a teacher of blind kids and have a wonderful, wonderful career.
And sounds like lots of job security as well. That's Galen Kapperman. He's a professor emeritus for the Visual Disabilities Program at NIU. I want to thank his colleague, Stacey Kelly. She also teaches at NIU. And Aliyah Landa Vilard, who's an assistant professor of the Low Vision and Blindness Program at ISU. All of you, thank you so much for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla, for the opportunity.
Before we end for today, we wanted to follow up on a story we brought you yesterday. We spoke to Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson moments before the Senate in Wisconsin was scheduled to vote on a bill that would allow children of any age to hunt with guns. And the Senate did pass that bill, 2112. It now heads to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's desk. We promised you an update on that story. As always, you can find information on past shows at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism at Northwestern University in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.